Lala.
And Leo. And tonight we have a special guest coming up at 8:30, Larry Dorman with the ASME Union,
he's the Public Workers Union. No, he's the Public Affairs Coordinator for the ASME Union. ASME represents state, county, and municipal employees throughout the country. And Larry is with Council 4 out of Hartford.
You have to, yeah. He's coming up about 8:30. And between now and then, we got a lot of interesting stuff for you. And I want to get right to it. We have some news. Yeah. First article I want to talk about was Homeland Security says it has every right to spy on peaceful protest groups.
Huh.
This is really a sick son of a bee. Okay, the Department of Homeland Security has concluded that it is perfectly reasonable for it to spy on dozens of peaceful advocacy groups and monitor scores of lawful protests and political rallies in the name of national security. The ACLU details the DHS response to a complaint the group filed with the DHS Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. The ACLU demanded an investigation into whether Department of Homeland Security officials abused their authority by improperly collecting and disseminating information regarding political demonstrations following revelations that Homeland Security Federal Protective Services had been engaging in such activities dating back to 2006.
How about that?
Yeah.
Pretty awful. Like they have nothing else to do? They're trying to justify their department?
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. And it says here...
The OCRL has refused to disclose the memorandum detailing its investigative findings. However, it sent a letter to the ACLU last week reaffirming that it sees no wrongdoing in the actions whatsoever, while admitting that there was no adequate differentiation between civil activists and violent extremist organizations. We strongly disagree with the OCRL's findings that the FPS acted with its authority to compile and disseminate a list tracking the political activities of advocacy groups, the ACLU states on its website.
No agency or department in government has the right to monitor the peaceful and lawful political activities and speech of Americans, the statement continues.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Protection from this type of government monitoring is exactly the reason why the First and Fourth Amendments were adopted. This government must immediately stop any ongoing programs or activities that monitor lawful political speech and advocacy of American citizens, it concludes.
Of course, asking the Department of Homeland Security to investigate itself on these matters is the equivalent of asking Charles Manson to chair his own parole hearing. The ACLU could not have expected any different result.
The federal government now openly admits that it spies on Americans and compiles lists of subversives if they choose to engage in their constitutional rights. Welcome to the new America.
Yeah.
What a bunch of... Now, you can find this on theprisonplanet.com.
By Stephen Watson.
Yeah, it's really sick. Really sick. Let me see. This is a... I won't play it, but he's saying... Ron Paul says it's time to let Germany and Japan pay for their own defense. I totally agree with that.
They have more money than we do.
I mean, why are we paying for their defense?
And this, millions of fish dead. That
one we covered last night.
Yeah.
But this is the sad part here.
Bradley Manning. Now catatonic.
Obama, enough. This is Bradley Manning is the guy who... gave all of the documents to WikiLeaks.
Yep.
And as Obama's crime of destruction of Bradley Manning continues to unfold before our eyes, Bradley Manning, David House, Manning's friend, David House, now tells us that over 8 months in isolation, with movement and sleep restrictions placed on him, have been having their intended effect. House has told MSNBC that by the end of January, Manning appeared catatonic, and that he had severe problems communicating, and it having taken House nearly 45 minutes on a recent visit to engage in any meaningful way.
House said Manning's demeanor was if he had just woken up and didn't know what was going on around him. Manning was utterly exhausted physically and mentally, and it was difficult to have any kind of social engagement. Oh, this is cruel.
Yeah. Well, this is the guy that leaked it here.
Also, a full month after the congressman, Dennis Kucinich, formally requested a visit, the Army has stalled on the request, all for the crime of reporting war crimes and criminal behavior, even among the highest-ranking military officials in Iraq.
In 2005, General Peter Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, it is absolutely the responsibility of every U.S. service member in Iraq if they see inhumane treatment being conducted to try to stop it. Chase Matter writes in Huffington Post that soon after deployment to Iraq, Manning soon found himself helping the Iraqi authorities detain civilians for distributing corruption in their own
for government. Distributing anti-Iraqi literature, which turned out to be an investigative report into financial corruption in their own government entitled, Where Does the Money Go? The penalty for the crime in Iraq was not a slap on the wrist. Imprisonment and torture, as well as systematic abuse of prisoners, are widespread in the new Iraq. From the military's own SIGAC, Significant Actions, reports, we have a multitude of credible accounts of Iraqi police and soldiers shooting prisoners, beating them to death, pulling out fingernails or teeth, cutting off fingers, burning with acid, torturing with electric shocks, and the use of suffocation and various kinds of sexual abuse, including sodomization with gun barrels, and forcing prisoners to perform sexual acts on guards and each other.
Like any good soldier, Manning immediately took these concerns up the chain of command. And how did his superiors respond? His commanding officers told him to shut up and get back to rounding up more prisoners for the Iraqi federal police to treat however they cared to. Manning also found a video and an official report on American airstrikes in the village of Granai in Afghanistan's Farah province, also known as the Granai Massacre. According to the Afghan government, 140 civilians, including women and a large number of children, died in those strikes. War crimes. This is the point of view of the Pentagon as it destroys Bradley Manning.
On the Hadatha killings, found to be collateral damage by the Army despite an American officer's unearthing and handing up the chain of command a video showing close-up bullet wounds, a recent Counterpunch article by Medina Benjamin and Charles Davis recounts, consider what happened to the U.S. soldiers who over a period of hours, not minutes, went house to house in Iraq, town of Hadatha, and executed 24 men, women, and children in retaliation for a roadside bombing. I watched them shoot my grandfather first in the chest and then in the head, said one of the two surviving eyewitnesses to the massacre, 9-year-old Iman Walid. Then they killed my granny. Almost 5 years later, not one of the men involved in this incident is behind bars. And despite an Army investigation revealing that statements made by the chain of command suggest that Iraqi civilian lives are not as important as U.S. lives, with the murder of brown-skinned innocents considered just the cost of doing business, none of their superiors are behind bars either.
Massacres of civilians in retaliation for IEDs seem to have been standard fare in Iraq. Ethan McCord says his unit was ordered to engage in 360 rotational fire and kill every mother's and
every mother bleep.
Yeah, and
in the street
in the event of an IED. The officer who gave the order was Colonel Ralph Kozlarich, the Lost Cause, who is featured in David Finkel's book The Good Soldiers. Colonel Kay is also the official executive officer who led the first investigation into the death of Pat Tillman.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Josh Deber, a McCord unit inmate who also witnessed the order, said the logic was to get residents to be proactive in preventing the planting of roadside bombs. Brass knew that the people in the houses nearest possibly saw it planted and didn't say anything. Diver on antiwarradio.com. Yeah, it was an order that came from Kozlarich himself, and it had the philosophy that, you know, as Finkel does describe in the book, that we were under pretty constant threat. And what he leaves out is the response to that threat. But the philosophy was that if each time one of those roadside bombs went off where you didn't know who said it, The way we were told to respond was to open fire on anyone in the area, with the philosophy that that would intimidate them to be proactive in stopping people from making these bombs. Now, 9 Afghan children have been killed after what the Army says was mistaken identity after a nearby rocket attack on American forces. These boys could have been the boys some on the site got to know well in New Year's global call for peace. They weren't, but they were just as precious. Defense Secretary Robert Gates once said people like Bradley Manning have blood on their hands for releasing documents which might identify Afghan informants. But look down, Robert, and don't flinch. They are dripping.
What they're doing is they're, I'm going to suggest you go to this website because...
There's a little audio there. What's that?
But I wanted to check. It says, Commander-in-Chief Obama ordered Bradley Manning released. They're telling you to
call the White
House. And that number, if you're interested, is 202-456-1111. Switchboard is 202-456-1414.
Also demand your congressman speak up and castigate this administration for the treatment of Bradley Manning, leaving a voicemail if it's after hours, 24/7, Capitol switchboard, 202-224-3121.
And let's see. This is 6 minutes. There's more stuff I want to go before.
That's very sad. That's from ukrainet.info.
Okay, and... I wanted to get here. Wait a second. That was crazy, too. This one was very interesting. Why is Hillary not defending the rights of Saudis to protest? Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had been exhaustively in front of cameras promoting the rights for people to protest in Egypt, Iran, and Libya. She's been touting the freedom to use social networking sites as a way for Arab people to organize against their oppressive regimes. Now the administration is even considering arming the opposition in Libya.
Clinton's perpetual propaganda effort exposed her bilateral hypocrisy, blatant hypocrisy, when a silent, peaceful protester was violently removed from one of her recent speeches on the very subject. However, the hypocrisy now seems to go much deeper in her deafening silence of the prospect for protests in Saudi Arabia. Well, we put that government in.
Yeah. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter. I don't want to go through this whole thing. I wanted to get back to...
Well, you can always go and get that article. Where is it?
Activist
Post.
Yeah, just check that out. And then let's go to... this one's really interesting. Activists shut down Bank of America branch. In Washington, D.C., 600 activists with National People's Action shut down a branch of the Bank of America Monday to protest the bank's record of dodging taxes. Funny that never came up on the mainstream media.
No.
National People's Action recently issued a report about how Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley have avoided paying billions of dollars in taxes. The study found that over the past 2 years, the 6 banks paid income tax at an appropriate rate, approximate rate of 11% of their pre-tax earnings in the United States, far less than the 35% that they are legally mandated to pay. By avoiding the taxes, the bank saved $13 billion. National People's Action reports this potential tax revenue could have been used to cover more than 2 years of salaries for some 132,000 teachers who lost their jobs since the economic crisis began in 2008. And hang on a second, there's more.
So it's funny that the Daily Paper didn't run anything today about yesterday's launch of a national Make Wall Street Pay campaign in Washington, D.C. It's funny because Bank of America was targeted in the protest. In fact, a Pennsylvania Avenue branch of Bank of America was essentially shut down by demonstrators who poured into the bank. They were protesting investment banks' part in the national financial meltdown and the bank's use of loopholes to avoid paying taxes. The National People Actions Group, which started the Make Wall Street Pay protest, says banks' financial duplicity makes it imperative that they contribute to the government revenue stream in order to avoid cutting programs for ordinary Americans.
The group's website is interesting and urges people to calculate the income they've lost since the financial crisis began in 2008, and then send their own bill to the representatives in Washington. Here's a short video of the protest in D.C. yesterday. Let's see. It really doesn't show the... You can't really click on to it.
Yeah, and you guys can't really
see
it.
But I'm going to tell you where to go and check out the group's website.
Group's website. Didn't come up. Oh, there it is.
Make Wall Street Pay is the name. Is the site, and they send them a bill. All right. So you can go to that site.
And you can sign up
and check it out. All right. Make Wall Street Pay. And,
so just put that into Google and it'll come right up. Make Wall Street Pay.
All right. And let's see. Let's go on to another one here. Okay.
Propaganda Swiss.
This is really interesting because this one here says... no-fly zone means war on Libya by U.S. Well, whether it's U.N. or not, it would be U.S. forces. And so a no-fly zone would mean, as Gates' current Secretary Gates correctly said, an act of war, because in order to enforce a no-fly zone, you first have to take out any possible anti-aircraft operations and the chances of planes flying up to engage your planes. So it means bombing the airfields, bombing every site where there is anti-aircraft guns or anti-missile emplacements. So that's a war. And it involves shooting down any planes that do not take off. So it's an act of war, and it becomes a war.
Well, we don't want that.
Well, McCain wants this thing to happen, and so does everybody else, calling for no-fly zones. Let's see, where
it's a long article.
It's an interview.
Okay. Yeah.
So I want to, we don't need that. But it is a war, and if you go into it, and you
so
can go
for
to Press
TV, no-fly zone means war on Libya by U.S., and it's
right.
An interview between Press TV and David Lindorf.
Right. So you check that out. And let's see, there's more here. This really, really pissed me off when I read it. Israel to get U.S. aid for a Middle East changes. Israel may seek an additional $20 billion in U.S. security assistance to help guard from the potential threats that could develop in light of recent changes occurring in the Middle East. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak told the Wall Street Journal in an interview published on Tuesday. The senior Israeli official also deemed the changes in the region a movement in the right direction, saying that in the long term, Israel should not fear the movement of Arab societies toward modernity. However, they want $20 billion to secure up their miserable existence. And Israel may seek an additional, the senior Israeli, Barak said that while Israel did not face an immediate threat to its security, the issue of qualitative military aid for Israel becomes more essential for us, and I believe also more essential for you, the U.S.
It might be wise to invest another $20 billion to upgrade the security of Israel for the next generation or so, he added, claiming that a strong Israel could become a stabilizer in the Middle East region. Israel spends roughly 9% of its gross national product to guard from potential threats. Its military expenditure amounts to $17 billion U.S. dollars this year, of which U.S. aid is $3 billion. Tel Aviv has kept a wary eye on the recent tidal wave of anti-government protests that has raced across the Middle East, originating with revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, which have swept long-standing autocratic rulers from power.
They want another $20 billion from us.
To keep that.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Government in place.
I don't think so. And that's it. And I want to. There's one more that I wanted to read tonight, and I'll get back to it in a second.
So what is the article?
It's the article on the unions that I wanted to...
Before we bring Larry on.
Right. I wanted to get to that in just a second here.
Takes us a minute to get it.
It's here somewhere.
Oh, the one on the unions, like what the Nazis did.
Yep.
That one. Let's see.
It's here.
Give us a
here
second.
It is, right here.
Hitler abolishes unions.
Yeah, before we bring Larry up tonight, hopefully he will be with us at 8:30. We wanted to say that in May 1933, Hitler abolishes unions. Now, this is from the News Junkie Post. Okay, you can get this article. On May 23rd, 1933, the day after Labor Day, Nazi groups occupied union halls and labor leaders were arrested. Trade unions were outlawed by Adolf Hitler, while collective bargaining and the rights to a strike were abolished. This was the beginning of the consolidation of power by the fascist regime, which systematically wiped out all opposition groups, starting with unions, liberals, socialists, communists, using Himmler's state police.
Fast forward to America today, particularly Wisconsin. Government Walker and the Republican Tea Party members of the state legislature are attempting to pass a bill that would not only severely punish public unions, with the exception for the police, fire, and state troopers unions that it supported his campaign, but it would effectively end 50 years to the right of these workers to collectively bargain. Collective bargaining is a process of voluntary negotiations between employers and trade unions aimed at reaching agreements which regulate working conditions. Collective agreements usually set out wage scales, working hours, training, health, and safety issues, overtime grievance mechanisms, and rights to participate in workplace company affairs. First of all, assaulting the rights of workers to collective bargain has absolutely nothing to do with an immediate budgetary issue. It does, however, have everything to do with ending one of the basic rights of labor to organize.
Second, and most importantly, the budget crisis in Wisconsin is more exaggerated and created in part by new Republican power base as a tool to attack political opponents. Walker decreased state revenue when he enacted tax cuts for the rich and big corporations, who are not surprisingly large campaign donors for his political campaign. To the extent that there is an imbalance, Walker claims there is a $137 million deficit. It is not because of a drop in revenues or increase in the cost of the state employee contracts, benefits, and pensions. It is because Walker and his allies pushed through $140 million in new spending for special interest groups in January. If the legislature were simply to rescind Walker's new spending schemes or delay their implementation until they are offset by fresh revenue, the crisis would not exist.
That's from the Capital Times, I think.
Right, Cap Times.
The Cap Times.
Disseminating unions has long been an objective of the rich.
Decimating.
That's what I thought it was.
No, you said disseminating. Decimating.
Oh, decimating unions. and the objective of the rich and powerful. Growing out of trade guilds in the medieval Europe, they were banned starting with the Ordinance of Laborers in 1349 and Statute of Laborers in England. It was not until the Industrial Revolution that labor began to organize again.
Every little game for the rights of workers was hard-fought and bitterly resisted by the rich and the powerful. The photo above, which you can't see, shows the Lawrence Textile Strike, also known as the Bread and Roses Strike, where mostly immigrant workers rebelled against increasingly harsh working conditions and lowered pay caused by mechanicization. Specifically, state law mandated a reduction in working hours for women and children from 56 to 54 hours, and factory owners responded by cutting salaries, something the poor workers could not afford.
Over time, organized labor managed to abolish child labor altogether, as well as institute an 8-hour workday, 40 hours work week, mandatory breaks, safety guidelines, grievance procedures, a minimum wage, and the concept of a work-free weekend, workers' comp, pensions, health safeguards, and paid sick days, vacation days, and holidays. If you enjoy any of these things, thank a union member and support the passage of the Strong Employee Free Choice Act. And collective bargaining in the U.S. was finally legalized for the public-private sector on a countrywide scale in 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act signed by FDR. JFK signed an executive order extending the right to the public sector in 1962. This is the key measure.
Governor Walker's bill sped through the Wisconsin legislature.
Let me just go back here. I just wanted to make sure that we're...
Sped through the Wisconsin legislature would mandate health insurance contributions by public employees, force them to pay more for their promised pensions, and remove bargaining rights. When public employees started protesting, Walker instructed the State National Guard to be prepared if any problems should arise in what could be described as a thinly veiled intimidation tactic.
Although the draconian bill will not outlaw unions, it will effectively neuter them as their CPI-adjusted wages will be frozen and all other means cannot be improved as a whole. Public sector unions will lose their freedom to negotiate against the state together. This is a deliberate tactic to punish political opponents and to effectively lessen the rights of working Americans everywhere for the benefit of the rich and multinational corporations.
I want to go.
This is extremely long article.
Yeah. Well, let's check and see
if Larry has called. And we can finish it later, but not quite yet.
No, it's not quite yet.
Did you want to take a little break, a music break for a minute?
Yeah, we can do that. We'll take a music break while we wait for our guest to call.
And we'll go, Richard, what do you want? No, not that one.
All You Can Eat, that's a good one.
No, not that one, just play that.
Booth?
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know what this one is.
Thank you.
short one.
That
wasn't
was
much of a
30-second job, right?
Yeah, I expected that to be a little,
right,
a little bit longer.
Well, this one will be.
Let's try this one.
Well, let's play this one. I like this one anyway. Why don't you want to All You Can Eat?
Yeah, I like that one. Demonstrators creative humor license. I didn't think that was so funny. But anyway.
The Americans for Prosperity Group, a Tea Party group that is a Koch brothers. Front, has put up a website for the Tea Party rally that attacks all collective bargaining, not just for public employee unions. In the fight for workers' rights in America, following the ultra-conservative sweep of many state legislatures and governorships in the 2010 midterms, most Republicans are salivating at the opportunity to destroy the last stronghold of organized labor in America, the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, more working people belonged to a union in the public sector, 7.9 million, than in the private sector, 7.4 million. Despite the fact that this corporate America employs five times the number of wage earners, 37% of government workers belong to a union, compared with just 7% of private sectors. That was from Alternet.
Let's just check and see if our...
I hope so.
No. Hello called, not yet. Okay.
Why don't I try calling him? Maybe he lost the number. No. Hit dial out like this. And...
You could try him.
Let me see if I can dial our guest up with this fantastic feature here. I hope I can. Maybe...
How do you pay for that?
That's just like on your phone. Here.
Oh, it's our phone that would be calling out?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I guess it's like telephone, you know?
Hmm.
Something like that. So let's see. Okay. I'm going to see if it works. I don't know.
Okay, we'll try to give a call.
Yet.
He usually calls us, but he hasn't called in yet.
It's here.
Maybe he got the time wrong.
Okay. Dial.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Larry Dorman?
Is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Just a second.
Oh, no.
You missed him.
Oh, no. Okay. Call back in there, Larry.
I'll try and call him.
Mm. Okay. This kind of sucks. All right. So we're going to try it one more time. Let's see. 860.
Hung up on something work-related, and I'm
trying to get to the phone, so I apologize.
Oh, no, that's all right. I can just imagine how busy you must be.
Well, we have things blowing up in New Haven, so that's actually what I've been dealing with. So, but I'm here.
Well,
I'm ready.
Oh, things are blowing up all over the country, I'm afraid.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So I apologize. So I'm ready when you are.
Well, we're ready right now. We just read an article that in 1933, Hitler abolished the unions. That was one of his infamous acts.
When he first got into power, he abolished all the unions. And once he did that, the standard of living plummeted 25% immediately.
In Germany.
Imagine that.
Well, what does that tell you?
That's what fascism does, and what it's all about.
They put a different kind of spin on it in the media, but you really can't put, you can't put lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
And that's what they've tried
well
to do.
Said. No, I've always said that, whether they're corporatists or fascists, and to me they're kind of one and the same, that one of the first things they'll do is try to outlaw unions and try to take away the rights of workers to bargain collectively, take away their freedom, and that's, unfortunately, we're getting perilously close to that.
We sure are. It's very scary. Now, I know that, of course, there's been a lot of attention in the media toward Wisconsin, but I know Ohio was also trying to do the same thing. And someone had told me at work that they had passed a bill in the Ohio legislature outlawing collective bargaining. Now, I didn't find anything on that. Is that true, Larry?
They have. It still has to go through, I believe, the Senate chamber, but it's a bill that is in some ways more draconian than Wisconsin in that it would try to outlaw the right to strike and binding arbitration. So it's crazy. There'd be no dispute resolution mechanism, period.
You know what amazes me is that that's Ohio. I mean, that's the heart of industrial America, all right?
Where the economy
is
just
decimated, okay?
You have, and you have a lot of union members in Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're on to something, and something we've talked about before, which is, welcome to the impact of globalization and, the free marketplace. There's been such an exodus of good-paying jobs out of states like Ohio, good-paying industrial and manufacturing jobs that, you've got an economy that's just completely different, where workers just have less bargaining power and fewer rights. And it's pretty alarming. And I think this is, what's happening in Ohio, what's happening in Wisconsin. I hate to sound this way, but it's playing out the way the corporatists have been drawing it up from the time that they started with the free trade agreements.
You know that Christopher Hedges, who writes for the Post, I believe, he's a columnist.
Yeah.
But he just came out with a new book entitled The Death of Liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard him the other day on the radio, and he was talking. He said that Bill Clinton, he called Bill Clinton a traitor, basically, to the working class and the middle class. He says he was the worst possible NAFTA. By him putting through NAFTA,
mm-hmm,
and destroying the welfare system as it was, as he just mutilated. He began the movement and single-handedly destroyed the American industry. Okay, and with this Free Trade Act, as well as threw people out on the street who were borderline anyway with their welfare programs. So. He just called him an outright horrible president and basically a traitor to the people that elected him.
Well,
but,
I think like I say, I think we've had this conversation, and I'm always appreciative of the fact that I think you and Lyle and I are on the same wavelength here. I'm not letting Democrats off the hook here because the free trade policies helped pave the way for the significant drop off in industrial manufacturing union membership. It empowered other countries, gave other countries an economic advantage. Didn't help, for instance, in NAFTA's case, didn't do anything for their Mexican workers. In fact, their misery indexes increased. American workers' misery indexes increased. And so how does that play out? You know, I think you can make a logical jump from free trade agreements and offshoring and outsourcing to what's happening in Ohio and Wisconsin, where damage has been done to the labor movement.
And it hasn't helped China either. When you look at what it's done as far as adding billions of tons of pollution to their air and water.
Terrible.
And,
incredible. Incredible.
Destroying their country. You know,
a few people live in proportion are living quite well, but the rest of the people have to live in that pollution.
And not only that, are living in tolerable wages. I mean, $1 a day. You know,
that's the thing is you can deconstruct all this stuff. Sensible people like you can deconstruct it. But again, the I call them, you know, the corporatists. They're apologists in the political hallways. They're amen corner in the media. They're all watching this happening and celebrating it.
Well, we have our own troubles right here in our state, where
what's happening in
New Haven.
Well, New Haven is interesting because it's sort of I'm calling it Wisconsin comes to Connecticut, in that you have Mayor John DeStefano, who unfortunately has no political opposition. One of our union presidents called him Hosni DeStefano, and he is looking to do and has done some grave damage to the people we represent in New Haven. He's playing the blame game and saying that workers' wages and benefits are a major reason why New Haven's economy is in the toilet. And he wants to privatize 200 school custodians out of their jobs, already hired a company, even though he can't do it yet. So he wants to create more unemployment. Just laid off 80-plus workers last month, including 16 police officers. So it's really is Wisconsin playing out in a large city in Connecticut, and it's something we're fighting in many fronts, but it really is kind of indicative of the mindset of a lot of kind of cowardly politicians.
Well, in Wisconsin, the governor in January passed huge tax breaks and incentives for the wealthy and for corporations, which in fact is the $137 million deficit that he's crying about.
Right.
Was it poor fiscal management that...
It was political payback.
I'm talking about New Haven now.
Oh.
Was it poor fiscal management in New Haven that created this debt that DeStefano is trying to reduce?
I think it's played a major role, Lila, as it is in a lot of communities. And before I answer your question, and I will, about New Haven, what's happening there is playing out in many communities, and I call it bloodlust. It's this scapegoating, blaming, pointing of fingers at middle-class workers as a means of deflecting attention from the root causes of what's going on here. And what's going on here is that, as we've discussed on your show, we had a military run-up of unparalleled and disastrous proportions. We had the Bush tax cuts. And then we had the Wall Street financial meltdown, which was just pure unalloyed greed by a handful of financiers and investors and bankers. And a lot of these corporations and a lot of these Wall Street moguls are doing quite nicely in this state.
Yeah.
And in this economy, and they helped drive us into the ditch. So not to defend the mayor, I have very little respect for him. New Haven's economic situation is an offshoot of what's happened statewide and across the nation, but there's been tremendous fiscal mismanagement, top-heavy bureaucracy in New Haven, lucrative pensions and jobs for people. New Haven has a school CEO. I don't know too many communities that have that, in addition to a superintendent, the school CEO.
I never even heard of that.
right.
Boy,
the CEO is pushing privatization. So there have been a lot of it has been poor fiscal management. Two examples, you know, because we've talked about them on this show. We've urged him to get into the get to support the state health care pool that's being legislated. He won't do that because the brokers don't want him to. We've urged him to get involved with the to participate in the state prescription drug pool plan, which already can happen. Municipalities can get on the state prescription drug plan because legislation our union fought for, and he's refused to do that. He's been had to. He's been being dragged, kicking and screaming to do all these things. So
what about,
that's it. Is a lot of mismanagement.
How's what about Dan Malloy? He's,
I knew you were
going
to get to that.
he's in a bit of hot water there, and rightfully so. So what are we doing with this, Larry?
Look, the thing I would tell anybody about the governor to date, you know, he did inherit, and we do have to all be cognizant of that. I mean, he inherited a tremendous mess created by Roland Rell, and then, of course, you know, this national economic meltdown. However, Connecticut is positioned to deal with it in ways that are make it better off, I think, than other states. And I'll give you the obvious example, but one your listeners may not realize. When Obama compromised and the Democratic Congress compromised on the Bush tax cuts and extending the Bush tax cuts in December, the top 5% of Connecticut wage earners realized a $3 billion windfall. So I want to repeat that. $3 billion extra went into their pockets simply because that compromise allowed them to not have to go back to have their tax rate, the highest tax rates restored. And we're not even talking about raising taxes. We're saying just return them to the level that were in the Clinton administration. So that compromise, and I'm quoting from a respected group called the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. They just released that study. Now, Connecticut has currently around a $3.7 billion deficit. So, you know, do the math. Rich people and corporations have done really well in this state. Around the state, our allies at SEIU and other unions are doing protests at the Bank of America. Why? Bank of America pays no state income tax. They've put thousands of families into foreclosure in Connecticut, and the research shows that 700 of their own employees are on the Husky, the taxpayer-subsidized Husky health care plan. So this is the problem. This is the problem in Connecticut. It's not the unions. It's not the middle-class workers, whether they're in a union or not. It's not state employees. It's not municipal employees and their pensions or their health care. The problem is the corporations and the extremely wealthy. They live here and do business here because it is very friendly for them.
And
they're not being asked to sacrifice.
You know, JP Morgan Chase, they are the contractors for food stamps. For the when they're processing the food stamps, the money.
Right.
It's JP Morgan Chase that's the major contractor for that.
You would think you were making, you know, you think that was like a joke if you said that to somebody.
No.
Yeah, I know it.
But they are contracted by the federal government, you know, to administer the food stamps, you know,
You're just putting public programs in the hands of private profiteers.
That's exactly right.
So when we talk about, you know, the governor, again, he did inherit an extremely difficult challenge. We all recognize that. But what we're saying is before you blame or before you seek or ask state employees to come up with about $20,000 out of their pockets, which I don't think anybody could do, take a look at the corporations. Take a look at the super rich. And you know, let's have an honest discussion about what we're doing here, because he's asking middle-class workers, whether they're state employees or not, to pay more taxes in the way of income taxes, to pay more sales tax, to lose the $500 property tax credit, to pay more tax on their coupons, because, you know, your coupon, you'd be taxed on the original value of the item at the supermarket versus the discounted value. So there's a lot of pain that's being visited in his budget, proposed budget, that's being visited on the middle class. And we need to take a look at the super rich and the corporations if we're going to do this fairly.
How receptive is he to listening to the unions on this?
I don't know how receptive he is. I would say to you right now, he's not very receptive. I think it's important that people contact him, that he get flooded with calls. You know, he's going to these town meetings, to his credit, and I will give him credit. He is not afraid to meet the public. He's not afraid to, in essence, try his case. He was a prosecutor. And obviously, the teabaggers are out there saying no taxes at all. And there's a lot of fingers that get pointed at these town meetings at state employees. But I think people really need to hold the governor and the legislature accountable and say, if you're going to fix the problem, fix it fairly and make sure that there really is shared sacrifice. Because right now it's being heaped on the shoulders of the middle class.
Absolutely. And he didn't get elected for that.
Nope.
And I feel like he's betrayed us. I really do. And the union supported him.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Am I ready to say that? No, because like I said, he does have an incredibly difficult job. He inherited a mess. You know, Roland and Rell were as bad as bad gets.
Oh, yeah.
So,
speaking of Roland, he's on the radio for hours each day,
beating up state employees,
talking against us.
Yep.
It's horrible to listen to him. That he would get that convicted felon would get that much airtime, and how what a nerve talking against the middle class.
TIC,
yeah, and I'm kind of glad you brought that up. I mean, how does that make you guys feel when you're trying to do the right thing and you see? I mean, I guess it kind of probably confirms in your minds, you know, that the media outlets that we have, the traditional media, are just pointless.
Oh, they're so sold out. It just makes me sick, you know. But I'm not, and I know Leo feels the same way. We're not going to give up talking about what we think is right, even though people like John Roland have the advantage over us right now.
I wish there were more people like you, because I think part of the problem is that folks need to really rise up. They need to develop alternative media. They need to boycott the advertisers, for example. Big Y supermarket advertises on Roland's show. They're notoriously anti-union company.
Really?
Yep.
I didn't realize that.
You know, maybe people shouldn't patronize Big Y. I mean, I think that workers and, you know, the middle class really have to start making hard decisions, you know, as consumers to start holding people accountable, because TIC is just, a local edition of Fox News on the radio.
Yeah.
And it's really distressing. We need more people like you out there and less people, obviously, like the convicted felon who somehow was governor.
Yeah, and to for hours in the afternoon, he gets to talk on the radio against people that you like, the people that you represent, like the people in my union who are hard workers.
Yeah, and I mean the fact that he can even have a voice after being, I mean, it's like G. Gordon Liddy, you know, is a popular right wing talk show host. The guy, you know, was in the Watergate break-in, for crying out loud, you know. He's got a talk show.
I certainly believe in redemption. I'm not against that, but
right.
These guys got redeemed.
But you know, Roland, you know, don't we should never use the words Roland and redemption in the same sentence. same guy he was 20 years ago. He's he's a hateful, manipulative, and cynical person. So the fact that Leo, you're right, the fact that he's even allowed on the air, it's almost laughable to these people that they get these jobs, like G. Gordon Liddy or John Roland, and they have a following.
I don't know if you ever knew, but I was a campaign manager for Ned Cole in 2002, and he ran against Roland.
He was a poverty worker in Hartford.
Yeah.
I like Ned. He's a good man.
Ned, right?
And
you can walk the
guy.
Beaches of Greenwich with to protest that they're closed to the public. Yeah.
Right. And but we're good friends with Earl with Ned, and we
went down to the Democratic convention.
We got the film. We're the only independent film crew that got to film the Democratic convention. We did a 2-hour documentary on it and played around the state. But the thing was is that Ned, the reason he ran against Roland is because he was the only guy who stood up and said Roland is corrupt. All right. He said Roland is corrupt, and he walked 160 through 160 towns in Connecticut with a sign that said Roland is corrupt. Honk for a vote. That called for governor. And
we walked in Waterbury.
We walked in Waterbury St. Patty's Day Parade.
Patty's Day Parade.
Yeah, we
crashed the parade with signs against Roland.
And we
That's
got
awesome.
By the way, because they liked Ned. They hated Roland. So
as usual, he was kind of a prophet.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you mean Ned? Ned thinks he is, yeah. And it was a riot, and it was. I learned a lot about activism working with Ned,
yeah.
And
he's a great guy.
The reason he did this, the reason he hated Roland so much, is because Roland gave him the finger. All right, he was picketing Roland outside the Capitol building.
Outside the State House.
And Roland came out. Was coming out the back door, and Ned was there with a sign. He went back in, and old Ned was just standing there with a sign, right? He goes back in to the Capitol building, comes out with two state policemen, all right? Goes to his car, his
limousine,
turns to Ned, sits down in the limo, looks at Ned, and gives him the finger.
From the limousine,
yeah.
And
that
infuriated Ned.
Ned got so pissed off. He said, "That's it. You know, that's it. He says, I'm going to run again. I'm going to expose you." You know, and he did. And he stood up. He stood up in front of 1,500 delegates and said, "You know, I'll never forget. I played it for the whole state. It was like hysterical." He got up and he said, "In fact, who was it? John Olson was the guy who did John." John was the MC for that, and he went up and got he tried to get Ned
to get off the stage
because Ned was calling
John Roland, the Prince of Darkness.
The Prince of Darkness, Snake Eyes.
That is such a good name.
I
was so proud of Ned that day. I really was.
Yeah, we were. And,
yeah,
but
we need more like him.
We sure do.
But you know, it was really funny. Out of the 1,500, I mean, you know, all of these doodah Democrats, all right, that were up there, none of them, everyone
reacted.
Was like, you should have seen the reaction. It was as though
it was the young people. What really
encouraged us
was that as soon as he spoke, every young person in that audience woke up and moved forward to listen to Ned.
Everybody under 25 or 30, everybody under 30 basically moved forward.
Got up and moved forward to hear what he had to say.
And applauded him
when
he said it. And the others actually booed him. You know, he actually got booed by the Democrats for calling Roland a crook and a bum and a snake and the Prince of Darkness and all this kind of stuff. And like I said, John will remember that. John pulled him off the stage. Tried to pull him off the stage.
Because he was only supposed to have 10 minutes or something.
Amazing.
But it was. But anyway,
that's the spirit we need.
Lieberman, who was this was in 2002. Lieberman had to make a statement. He didn't show up at the convention.
Well, because it was on Saturday.
It didn't matter. He was still in Washington, and He made a statement to the public statement condemning Ned supporting Roland's dignity, right? You know, and saying this was unprofessional, this is uncalled for to call the standing governor a crook and so on and so forth. And yet, 1 year later, what?
The guy is indicted and you know, is serving time. So,
well,
yep.
Anyway, what we have on our radio.
And
he
was reelected and serving time. You know, it was pretty sick.
Well,
but,
it shows you what power the media has, and it sways so many people. It really does.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people.
Yeah, you know, the liberal, like that famous liberal media is actually, like I say, they're part of the Amen chorus that's allowing the corporations and the wealthy and the powerful to stomp on everyone else, and we need to figure out how to stop that.
Chris Hedges' new book, I was listening to him on NPR today, and he said that it was the death of liberalism. Okay, was the name of it, and you know, he's a liberal. But he was saying what the real deal is and how liberals in the establishment, liberals, he says, are marginalized, and he says now are corporatized, he says, to the point where they've lost all their credibility. And you know, he says, you can't take the Democrats seriously anymore. And the Republicans, but you know, the Democrats have lost all their credibility because now their message is virtually the same as the Republicans, you know, in Washington.
In Washington, anyway.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish, and you know, and who knows, maybe in Connecticut, it's we got a hell of a fight on our hands.
We sure do. I mean, you must be busy every single day and every single night thinking about this, Larry.
It's an honor. You know, I really do mean that. It's, you know, and you guys are in the same position. You're standing up and fighting for what you believe in. And, you know, we all have to do that. If we don't, then that's when we're all really in big trouble.
Well, then we become part of the problem. I mean, you can't expect someone else to solve all your problems for you. You have to be a part of the movement to solve it.
And then look, you know, you hope that what's happened in Wisconsin and Ohio will serve to galvanize a broader movement of working people to stand up, to fight, and to say enough is enough. We're tired of being blamed, and if in the end that's where it gets us, some of this pain will have been worth it. But you know, we're not going to get there without some serious fighting and battling.
What do the unions think about striking? As far as I'm concerned, you get a few garbage companies to strike, and they have some smelly garbage all around where the representatives and senators are. Things begin to change fast.
Well,
you know?
I think so. You know, obviously the strike is, you know, from a sort of academic or, you know, analytical standpoint, it's, you know, been used with it's been a decreasingly used tool for a whole lot of reasons. And in the public sector, for example, in Connecticut, you know, we have binding arbitration. Public employees can't strike. So, but I think that if you want to kind of get back to the, there's certainly a school of thought that would tell you that if we want to get back to fighting, we want to get back to building a stronger working class consciousness, that shutting down industries and shutting down streets and bridges might not be a bad thing. And I can understand why people would say that.
Well,
I think so. I would support that highly, you know, for, you know, to keep people employed.
Well, it really is a fight, because this is class warfare that's going on.
Yes, thank you for saying that. It is. It's absolutely,
and
there's no other way to describe it.
Fighting for our lives, really.
Mm-hmm.
And our life, well, which is this one and the same. Your livelihood and your life are really interconnected. And, you know, we can step around it, but that's what we're fighting for. And the fight is becoming harder and closer all the time.
Yeah, it seems every time we talk to each other, something new has cropped up, and it's just going to be the way of our world, you know, moving forward. But hopefully people will, like I said, if the net effect is to galvanize a stronger movement and consciousness, that will be a good thing.
I think so, too, and I really appreciate the fact that you have come on our show to talk about this.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Appreciate
we
you
want
having
to keep
me.
It alive. And
good. Stay in touch.
We hope.
What were you saying, Larry?
Larry?
Yeah, no, please stay in touch. I'd love to come back on and
You're always
keep the updates.
Good.
And I'll have to listen more to the blog, actually, and hear how I sound.
You sound great.
You sound very good.
Thanks for having me.
You really do. Thanks so much for being on, and stay strong.
Good.
We'll talk next month.
All right. Thanks.
Take care, guys.
Yeah.
Good night, Larry. That was Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union talking about
coordinator and
what's been happening.
You can go to councilfort.org and listen to Larry, and see some of his articles and see what's happening.
And you can get it.
The AFSCME, AFSCME website as well, AFSCME.org.
Mm-hmm. It'll give you a way to get involved and to help yourself, too.
Yeah.
Although AFSCME represents the state, county, and municipal employees, what they're doing helps you.
Right. So I just want to thank you for joining us. Join me tomorrow night when we venture into the fourth dimension. And
And by the way, just for people who don't know, today was the first day of the ninth wave.
Ninth wave of the Mayan calendar, right, which is the
Ash Wednesday also.
Which means this is the very last wave of the last, this is the last of the 7 days.
That's right.
Okay, so we're at the end time. And we'll be talking a little. Maybe I'll talk a little about that tomorrow night. But join me 8:00 right here. And I want to thank everybody for joining us, and hope you had a good. We hope you enjoyed Larry's conversation. And please support the unions; they need it. All right. And good night.
When you do, you're supporting yourself and your neighbors.
Yeah. So have a good evening, and we'll talk to you.
Good night.
We'll talk to you.